Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. And this is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, May 26th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a first look at the weather forecast today. And hasn't the weather been great this past week? This forecast comes from KCRG in Cedar Rapids. Another excellent weather day is expected across eastern Iowa, though we will see some first signs of a warming trend beginning today. Clear skies and slightly lighter winds are expected throughout Friday, with highs reaching the mid to upper 70s for most. A few spots along the western and southern edges of the area could reach 80 degrees. Humidity will remain low, though, so the air should feel quite comfortable. Lows tonight will be in the 40s again, but likely not quite as cool as expected today. This sets us up for another slight increase in highs, with upper 70s and low 80s likely on Saturday. Full sunshine is expected again for most of the time, though. The rest of the holiday weekend plays out like it starts out. An increase in our temperatures a little bit each day, and lots of sunshine throughout, too. Highs reach the mid-80s for most by Memorial Day itself. Being able to tolerate that kind of warmth is the only limiting factor, weather-wise, for activities and ceremonies to mark the holiday. Warmth continues to build through the rest of the week, reaching the upper 80s on Tuesday, and even potentially surpassing 90 degrees for part of the time later in the week. Humidity levels should inch higher as well, so there may be a bit of a muggy feel to the air by Wednesday and beyond. This eventually gives us a limited chance of showers and storms by Friday, which would certainly be welcomed by then after a long, dry stretch. Now let's turn to the front page of the Courier and see what we have there for stories today. They include Stronger Safety Net Sought in Farm Bill, Artists Line Up for First 50, and let's begin reading the top story, ESA Program Prepares Launch. Company paid $4.3 million to run private school educational accounts. This story was filed by Aaron Murphy of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline Des Moines. The New York-based company that will operate Iowa's new state-funded private school financial assistance program will be paid $4.3 million over the first 6 years, according to the terms of the contract with the state. Odyssey, which was chosen by the state through a competitive bidding process, will be paid from the state's general fund budget, the governor's office said. The company, which operates similar programs in Arizona and Idaho, this week began educating Iowa parents through a series of webinars about the new state program, which is expected to ultimately cost the state $107 million in the first year and $345 million annually at full implementation. The new program, passed with only Republican support in the legislature, was signed into law by Governor Kim Reynolds, who had pushed for similar measures in previous years and made it a centerpiece of her 2022 re-election campaign. Under the new law, Iowans will be eligible for state funding equal to the amount of state per pupil funding for K-12 public education, which, for the 2023-24 school year, will be roughly $7,600 to pay for attending private school. The educational savings accounts, or ESAs, must first be used to pay for tuition and fees. Any remaining funds can be used for other eligible expenses like textbooks, computers, or tutoring sessions. Odyssey will host a marketplace that will serve as the only eligible place for Iowa families to spend ESA funding on those other eligible expenses. Any purchases made outside Odyssey's marketplace will not be eligible for reimbursement, a company official said this week during a webinar. A spokesman for the governor's office said Odyssey will not receive any portion of those marketplace sales. Odyssey will be paid by the state roughly $1,000 annually to operate the program according to the contract's terms. Student eligibility. In the first year of the program, the ESAs are available to all public school students, all kindergarten students, and private school students in a household at or below 300% of the federal poverty level. For example, $90,000 annually for a family of four. In the second year, the 2024-25 school year, the program will be expanded to include the same population plus private school students in households at or below 400% of the federal poverty level. In the 2025-26 school year, the program will be open to all K-12 Iowa students, regardless of income. Webinars held. Odyssey this week began holding webinars to inform Iowa parents on how to enroll in the program. Over the course of the webinar, a company official described how parents can apply for ESAs, how the application and approval process will work, and who is eligible for the program. The state plans to begin accepting applications for the 2023-24 school year on May 31st, and that application period will be closed June 30th. The online application will determine whether the student is eligible for an ESA by using personal identification and tax filing information. During the webinar, Odyssey founder Joe Connor said the company will not share that personal information and will protect the applicant's privacy. Connor said in most cases, once an application is submitted, the eligibility verification process should take roughly a half hour. He said in rare cases, more documentation may be required to determine a student's eligibility. ESAs will begin to be funded on July 15th, Connor said. At that point, the parent will log into the program's website and declare which private school the student plans to attend for the 2023-24 school year. Eligible purchases. Any purchases made with ESA funds must be made through the Odyssey-hosted marketplace, Connor said. The company will work with vendors that will provide educational products and services that are eligible under the program, he said. Examples of what products and services are eligible and ineligible for purchase with ESA funds can be found at the Iowa Department of Education's website, educateiowa.gov. Criticism voiced. State Auditor Rob Sand, a Democrat, during a public event this week in Cedar Rapids, bemoaned a lack of accountability and transparency over how hundreds of millions of taxpayer dollars are spent by private schools. Comparatively, when Iowa public schools receive state funding, budgeting requirements restrict how public schools can spend public money, Sand told reporters following a town hall in Cedar Rapids on Tuesday. Public schools are required to hold public meetings, release public records, and receive annual audits to publicly track how they're spending taxpayer dollars. Private schools are not required to follow those same requirements once they start receiving money this fall from the publicly funded education savings accounts. The only prohibition under the law is that private schools cannot refund, rebate, or share any portion of ESA payments made back to the parent or family that paid it to the school. Quote, literally anything else they want to do with that money is legal, Sand said. Quote, if they want to take it as profit, that's fine. If they want to send their principal on an all-expense-paid trip to Europe, that's legal. There is no obligation that they actually take those public dollars and put them into educating kids. That's absurd to me, unquote. Reynolds and the Republican state lawmakers have said all schools, be they public or private, are accountable to parents and students, and that if parents and students feel that a school is not meeting their needs, they now have the flexibility and ability to choose the educational setting that best fits their needs. Reynolds, speaking to reporters earlier this month at the State House, said, quote, the closed system we put in place with Odyssey will help make sure that we're tracking fraud and that expenses are allocated in a manner that it was intended to do, unquote. Quote, so we have pretty good system in place, Reynolds said. We're very confident about that. That will allow us to monitor the expenditures, make sure they're being utilized in a proper manner. And, you know, it's a small state. We'll be able to see which schools are doing what and how it's being ran and operated. The governor added that a lot of other states are watching what we're doing and that it's imperative that we do it right and are vigilant in monitoring how the money is spent. Next, we have a story written by Melody Parker titled Artists Line Up to Submit Artwork for the 10th First 50 Show at Hearst Center for the Arts, Dateline Cedar Falls. The story begins with a color photograph of artists lined up in lawn chairs outside the building and down a sidewalk. And the caption says, at least 54 artists lined up Thursday morning to have their artwork be accepted for the First 50 exhibition at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls. Now to the story. At exactly 3:11 a.m. Thursday, April Gorton planted herself on a bench outside the front doors at the Hearst Center for the Arts. She was determined to be the first person in line for the 9 a.m. First 50 2023 artwork drop-off. And she succeeded. Her mixed media work, with its positive body message of being worthy, was the first piece accepted by curator Emily Drennan for the First 50 exhibition. Quote, life is an adventure, said Gorton, smiling. Quote, I love art, and I love the Hearst Center. I thought it might be the only time I could ever have a piece displayed in a gallery, so I got here early, unquote. Steve O'Brien, also of Waterloo, arrived at 4 a.m., staking his claim as second in line with an abstract drawing he made. Quote, I wanted to make sure I got my piece in. This is terrific. What an opportunity it gives us amateur artists to show our work, he enthused. By 8:30 a.m., at least 54 people had gathered, with more trickling onto the sand and sidewalk in front of the center. People huddled in small clusters or set up camp chairs, wrapping themselves in blankets and sweaters against an overcast, surprisingly chilly and breezy May morning. At 9 a.m., Hearst Center staff began admitting artists in groups of five, accepting the pieces, labeling and cataloging each work as it came through the door. Work had to be original by the artist and ready to hang or display, as well as represent the theme patterns. No medium was off limits. Painting, ceramics, mixed media, mosaics, textiles, wood art, photography, and more have been featured in previous First 50 shows. The pieces will be displayed in the biennial gallery show from June 15th to August 6th. It's the 10th year for First 50, which has become a beloved community tradition. Drennan will install the exhibition, the Dahl Thomas Gallery, giving it the same importance as any exhibition mounted at the Hearst. Anyone who expects to view artwork created by well-known Cedar Valley artists will be surprised. Many pieces have been created by people who don't necessarily consider themselves artists. There's something special, a little intimidating, about sharing artwork with the public, but the people in line were willing to chance it. Quote, I'm a stay-at-home mom, and I'm not a morning person, said Caitlin Robinson of Cedar Falls, laughing. While her daughter Elizabeth, too, was at home with Dad, Caitlin was opening her camp chair and sitting down in line, 35th, at 7 a.m. Robinson had created art since childhood, but only began working in mixed media a little over a year ago. Quote, I came because I've always wanted to have a painting in an art center or museum. My family think it's awesome and have been very supportive, unquote. Hearst Center Executive Director Corey Herless roamed the grounds, visiting with artists in line and encouraging everyone to warm up with a free cup of coffee. Quote, I've also been peeking a bit at the art, she confessed. Quote, I've seen a lot of interpretations of the patterns theme. They took the theme to heart. There's also a great variety of ages represented and lots of 2D and a few 3D pieces that I've noticed. It's my first ever First 50, and it's been a great experience, said Herless, who joined the Hearst Center in December. When Rebecca Chadwick of Cedar Falls, a fear-free certified veterinarian, arrived at 6:15 a.m., she immediately set up a small tent where she could lounge on a big cushion protected from the wind. Quote, my body does not like camp chairs, said Chadwick, who was recently diagnosed with hypermobile Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, a connective tissue disorder. That didn't discourage her from showing up with her black and white zebra line art, a piece she connected to processing the emotions of finally getting a diagnosis, she said. Standing nearby, artist Larry Erickson of Cedar Falls waited patiently with his contemporary oil portrait of a youthful Paul McCartney. Quote, the Hearst Center is a gem, he said, noting that he'd exhibited work in a previous First 50 show. A new member of Thursday Painters, Erickson welcomed the opportunity to exhibit his work, but, quote, I also came for the sense of community, unquote. Renee Wilkie of Cedar Falls placed her mosaic guitar on a stand while seated in a camp chair on the sidewalk. The stained glass artist previously has had her work displayed at the Hearst, and at 26th in Line looked forward to seeing the guitar in the gallery. Quote, these are contemplative prayers, and I give old guitars new life and purpose, said Wilkie. She described the process of choosing colors and patterns to create in glass, beads, and buttons as something that just happens. 11-year-old Samantha Fink of Cedar Falls was the youngest artist in line, with an acrylic painting waiting with her mom Michelle and brother. Quote, art allows me to express myself, Fink said, adding that painting is her primary medium. Quote, this is my first time here. Getting into the show means I've achieved something great, unquote. Our next story was written by Caleb McCullough of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Stronger safety net sought in Farm Bill. Priorities for funding discussed by farmers and members of Congress. Dateline Des Moines. Iowa farm groups and congressional representatives said a strong safety net for farmers is vital as Congress works to reauthorize a key agricultural bill for 2023. In the 2023 Farm Bill, increasing the baseline funding for programs like crop insurance that help cover losses from natural disasters or low revenue would help farmers deal with high production costs and uncertain futures, said Iowa Farm Bureau Federation President Brent Johnson. The federal Farm Bill is a sprawling legislative package reauthorized every 5 years that deals with farming, rural development, nutrition, conservation, forestry, and more. It lays out several key farm programs like the safety net programs, as well as agricultural research and nutrition assistance. It was last passed in 2018 and will need to pass by fall this year to keep certain programs functional. Production and input costs have increased significantly since 2020, some steeply outpacing inflation, Johnson said. Quote, the cost of production right now is higher than our expected revenue come this fall, Johnson said. Quote, and to deal with 200-300% inflation, knowing that our cash flows are upside down currently, that puts real risk into communities, unquote. The production cost of corn in 2023 is estimated at between $930 and $1,115 an acre, according to a report from the Iowa State University. In 2019, the same production was estimated to cost between $640 and $775 an acre. Aaron Lehman, the president of the Iowa Farmers Union, echoed the call for an updated safety net. He also said the farm bill should include a competition title to address consolidation in the industry. Lehman attributed some of the increase in production costs to consolidation on both the input side and the markets farmers sell to. According to the National Farmers Union's 2023 policy book, four companies controlled 85% of the corn and 76% of the soybean seed market in 2015. And similar consolidation exists when it comes to pesticides and livestock. Quote, we think that this farm bill ought to include a competition title so that these marketplaces are transparent and they deal with supply and demand forces rather than price manipulations that may be taking place, he said. Farmers heard. Four members of Iowa's congressional delegation, Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, and Representatives Randy Feenstra and Zach Nunn, all Republicans, sit on their respective agricultural committees in Congress and have been participating in hearings and markups over the last year. Feenstra, who represents Iowa's Northwest 4th Congressional District, said in an emailed statement that protecting crop insurance has been the top priority for farmers that he's met with in the district. Quote, during every meeting that I've held, the top priority for our agricultural community remains strong protections for crop insurance. I agree 100%. We must maintain and strengthen crop insurance, particularly as we've endured devastating derechos, tornadoes, droughts, and floods over the last several years, he said. He also said strengthening biofuel production, increasing foreign trade, and promoting young farmers were among his goals for the bill. A spokesperson for Ernst said the senator is looking to increase regulation on foreign investment in American farmland by updating the 1978 Agriculture Foreign Investment Disclosures Act. She also wants to improve animal disease preparation, increase foreign trade, and put more scrutiny on the U.S. Department of Agriculture spending, the spokesperson said. Quote, as I've traveled from river to river across Iowa, I've heard directly from folks across the state at multiple farm bill roundtables on issues of trade, conservation, crop insurance, and foreign influence in American agriculture, Ernst said in an emailed statement. Quote, in addition, we've discussed areas where the federal government can do a better job of working with the agriculture community, not against them, unquote. Feenstra and Ernst also expressed varying levels of support for changes to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the federal program that provides money to low-income people to purchase food. Ernst's spokesperson said the senator is looking at ways to ensure there is less fraud, waste, and abuse in this program intended for the most vulnerable, unquote. Feenstra pointed to his support for the America Works Act, a bill backed by more than 40 House Republicans that would increase work requirements for SNAP. Increasing work requirements for federal benefits is also a priority for House Republicans as they negotiate with Democrats over raising the nation's debt ceiling. But the proposal is opposed by Democrats. If that is not included in the final deal, the issue is likely to come up again in the farm bill. Debt ceiling delays. As President Joe Biden and congressional leaders work to reach a deal on raising the country's debt limit, Congress's agriculture committees have less certainty about how much spending can be allocated to the farm bill. Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley said this month, the delay in settling the debt limit dispute is delaying the writing of the farm bill. He said Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, had floated delaying the bill until September. But Grassley said work should start earlier with spending estimates. Quote, it's just this simple. You put in what numbers you want to put in, and then you dial them up or down depending on what the top line of government spending is for 24, he told reporters this month. Both Johnson and Lehman said they were worried debt limit negotiations could delay the farm bill, or that overall budget cuts could restrict the spending power of the farm bill. House Republican leaders are demanding spending cuts as part of a deal to raise the debt ceiling. Quote, the farm bill only comes around once every 5 years as planned, Johnson said. To have it potentially follow up the debt ceiling conversations, to know that the conversation could potentially impact production, agriculture, and rural communities for the next 5 years, the life of this next farm bill is a valid concern. It would be short-sighted to have the farm bill be drastically impacted by the debt ceiling conversations going on, unquote. Now let's turn the page to the Cedar Valley section, Marsha's Memorial Day custom. Tradition of placing flags on veterans' graves for Memorial Day continues at Waterloo Cemetery. Story written by Andy Malone, and it opens up with a color photograph of people placing flags on grave sites, and the caption says, Mercy One employees Joe Surma, Stephanie Egan, Darcy Pitson, and Diane Jurgensen are among the volunteers to help place flags on veterans' gravestones at the Garden of Memory Cemetery in Waterloo on Thursday. And we see lots of American flags in the photograph. Dateline Waterloo, a pre-Memorial Day activity started by the late Marsha Corbett in the Garden of Memory Cemetery, continues to go strong. Corbett, who served in the Army Medical Corps during World War II, headed up the effort to place flags on what's become a few thousand veterans' graves. She died in 2021 at the age of 98. Quote, it's become a tradition, said James Lentfer, one of the organizers of the event, which was held Thursday morning with several dozen volunteers. Quote, we're trying to continue in the footsteps of Marsha. She really did have a heart for veterans, and we've done a great job all these years, even through the rain, unquote. Participants went out in pairs, trios, or larger groups with lists and maps, bundles of flags, and an iron poker in hand. They completed the work faster this year than in recent memory because of the sheer number of participants and a nice day without any rain. Quote, we have a lot of work to do, but it looks pretty nice when it's all done, said Lentfer. Veterans buried at Garden of Memories, located at 3669 Logan Avenue, included those who served as far back as World War I and II. The tradition's been carried on by Lentfer and fellow Navy veteran Yolando Loveless, Blackhawk County's Director of Veterans Affairs. They have more than 50 years of service between them. They're assisted greatly by cemetery manager Christy Frost. Thursday's groups included representation from Mercy One, Koloff Media, and the Cedar Valley Rotary Club, to name a few. East High School, the University of Northern Iowa, veterans, and others with connections to those who have served are also represented among the volunteers. Quote, there's no better way of showing our honor and respect than by putting flags next to their graves, said Loveless, who got involved after traveling to the honor flight to Washington, D.C., and seeing how Arlington National Cemetery is well kept. Navy veteran Sean Clark of Waterloo went out to the cemetery with his daughter, Nikki. It was their third year participating, and the pair had about 100 veterans on their list. Quote, I'm a veteran, so it's a way to give back, he said. Sometimes you come across ones from World War II, a couple from World War I. Their families have probably forgotten them because you don't often go to see your great-great-grandfather, unquote. The Mercy One Waterloo Foundation had a four-person group participating. Among them was its manager, Joe Surma of Waterloo, a veteran of the Army National Guard. Quote, I hope somebody does it for me someday, was the sentiment he shared with another volunteer, Air Force veteran Darren Sommerfeld of Waterloo. Carol Schulte of Evansdale, who is from a military family, was another volunteer. She noted how she has uncles, aunts, and cousins among the deceased in the cemetery. And there were some heart felt surprises too. Candy Nordini of Waterloo came across a newly plotted grave of an old boyfriend's father. She was able to add his name to the list of veterans to be passed on to groups for years to come. Quote, "We've been coming out here maybe 5 years," she said. "My dad was a World War II veteran, so veterans are so important to me. This is just a little something we can do to remember them and their sacrifices," unquote. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, May 26th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Waterloo. Spencer R. Lafler, 30, of Waterloo, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, May 23rd, at Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Visitation for Spencer will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, May 30th, at Brosh Chapel at the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids, located at 2121 Bowling Street, Southwest. Celebration of Life services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, May 31st, at Brosh Chapel. A full obituary may be viewed and online condolences left for the family at www.broshchapel.com. Next, Deborah Garland Johnson, née Deborah Diane Garland, passed away on May 21st from cancer at the full age of 77 in Juneau, Alaska. Debbie was born and raised in the Midwest, raising a family of her own in Iowa, but also living in Minnesota, New York, and South Carolina over the years, before moving to Alaska after getting both of her boys, Matthew and Noah, out of the house. She was an educator who taught English at all levels, from primary school to college, before transitioning to special education. She loved sports, the great outdoors, music, art, visiting her friends, and spending time with family. A memorial service for Deborah will be held at the Cedar Valley Unitarian Universalist Fellowship at 3912 Cedar Heights Drive in Cedar Falls, Iowa, at 1:30 p.m. on Saturday, June 3rd, with light refreshments to follow. Now here the Courier lists 5 death notices, and they include Amy Marie Bowers, 31, of Denver. She died Monday, May 22nd, in Waterloo. Arrangements are being made by Lock on 4th. J.C. L. Hickok, 64, of Waterloo, died Tuesday, May 23rd, at Mercy One Waterloo. Arrangements are with Lock Funeral Services. Justin John Long, 32, of Lynchburg, Virginia, died Friday, May 12th, in Lynchburg. Arrangements are with Kaiser Corson Funeral Home in Shell Rock. William Albert Smith III, 58, of Denver, died Monday, May 22nd. Arrangements are with Haggerty Wyckoff Grawrup Funeral Service on West Ridgeway. And Sherry Lynn Spillman, 55, of Waterloo, formerly of Moline, died Monday, May 22nd, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital. Arrangements for Sherry are being made with Locke at Tower Park. Now let's turn the page to the opinion section. Our first editorial comes from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, editor Art Cullen. The title is "Nothing to Plug the Drain." Iowa's brain drain is nothing new. Rural areas especially have always shipped off their youth out of state and to the cities where the action is. But it's getting worse for a number of reasons, many of our own making. Iowa has the 8th worst retention rate of college graduates in the country and is the worst among its Midwestern neighbors. The principal reason is lack of jobs to fit a college degree. We have plenty of openings in meatpacking, but not so much in electrical engineering. Second, our salary structure does not support our level of student debt. Iowans have among the highest debt loads in the country upon graduation. To pay off the debt, you must attain a higher salary in the Twin Cities or Chicago. The legislature has been forcing tuition increases by limiting appropriations to public and private colleges over many years. Because of massive income tax cuts, primarily, it will be difficult to reduce the cost burden on students. When you lose ground in educational attainment, as rural Iowa is, you lose income and investment locally. You lose independent ownership and capital. It becomes a circular dynamic that feeds the rust we see in our small towns. As if the economic reasons weren't enough, the legislature and Governor Kim Reynolds keep piling on with bad ideas that turn off young people and motivate them to leave. Old people, too. Gay bashing, book banning, and trash-talking immigrants does not give Iowa the impression of being an open and welcoming place to plant yourself and your family. Young people say they are fleeing the state because of the hard swing right over the past several years. Even if they are straight white Christians, many do not feel like they belong here. Iowa voters have given complete control of state government to the Republican Party, which cannot resist its base impulses. There is no countervailing force telling them to cool it. The Democrats are lost out in the corn maze with promising young leaders who talk among themselves, abandoned by the national party. There is nothing to change that dynamic. The talk of politics will be all about the Republicans. There is no big statewide race in 2024 to energize legislative campaigns. Reynolds dominates the agenda. There will be nothing to constrain Republicans from going further overboard the next session heading into an election. They must fire up the base. For starters, eliminating the progressive income tax is a huge target. Driving deeper cultural wedges over abortion, race, and sexual mores will prove irresistible. That is, it only will get worse. Universities have a big target on them by the anti-elite crowd. Students will not get a break on tuition. They won't be able to afford a job in Cherokee or Pocahontas if they ever want to buy a house. Minnesota is going a different direction than Iowa and retains far more of its young people. Say what you will about Chicago, but it remains the top destination for young Iowans. They are bailing out for economic and cultural reasons. So are their parents. Many people who find themselves at retirement leave not for tax reasons, but because they think the place has gone off kilter. It has. Because we lack balance in government. No force is in place to restore a sense of moderation at this point. More people will leave, and we will be poorer for it. Next, we have an editorial by Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times-Pilot, titled, "Who Cut Your Pork Chop?" Ron DeSantis was railing about illegal immigration while grilling pork chops at the annual picnic on May 13th in Deep Red Sioux Center, hosted by Representative Randy Feenstra, Republican from Hull. The crowd cheered him on, knowing full well that immigrants cut the chops and work the dairy barns around northwest Iowa. It's an open secret that livestock economy virtually depends on immigrants, mainly from Latin America, to put cheap pork on your grill and cheese in your larder. Everybody knows we couldn't get by without them. Yet we cheer on the most strident anti-immigrant outrage. What gives? Do they resent that corporations have taken over pork and dairy production? Because they scarcely could exist without immigrants. Help wanted signs are everywhere. You hear it all the time. We just can't find help. The legislature wants you to prove work for welfare with a 2.8% state unemployment rate. It just loosened up child labor laws, too. In rural food processing hubs like Sioux Center or Storm Lake, it takes someone bent on the American dream to scoop manure or work in the blood drying room. Tyson pays $21.50 to start at the Storm Lake pork plant and cannot keep the roster full. How would you like to load turkeys on a truck at 2 a.m. when the sleet whips sideways and that squawking feathery rage is coming right at you. Yet we clap when someone talks about keeping Venezuelans, Cubans, Salvadorans, Hondurans, and Mexicans out. Donald Trump made fear-mongering over foreigners his theme, and won Iowa handily, despite the fact that it is a land full of folks descended from Germans, Dutch, Norwegians, and Swedes. Storm Lake and Sioux Center are growing, the latter up 17% to 8,200 population in the past decade. In Storm Lake, voters keep on approving bond issues for schools where children of immigrants fill the classrooms. Both communities boast strong main streets with full storefronts and lots of huge late-model pickups. Other towns would kill for the vitality. Yet Feenstra jabbers on as much about immigrants being a problem as any Republican House member. In fact, they are an opportunity. We don't have mountains with ski slopes and dramatic vistas. We have corn and hogs. It's tough to keep kids down on the farm once they've seen Des Moines or suburban Minneapolis. Who's going to milk the cows or cut the bung out of a hog hanging upside down? Billy went off to be a commodities broker at the Chicago Board of Trade, and his parents back in Sioux County are proud. But we still have work to do here. Honest work. Hard work. Few others want to do it. Those are facts, too. We rely on Latinos to get her done. Why, then, would you want to deport people who are indispensable to your dairy? Well, they weren't really thinking about the milking parlor. They were thinking about those people at the border muling so many opioids their calves are bulging, like former Representative Steve King, Republican from Kiron, described. That's what people are told over and over and over on AM radio, on cable news, on social media, and by their congressmen and their senators. It's the power of propaganda. The problem is not with the person they know, but the boogeyman who has been created to keep our fear stoked. If you are going to wage a war, you have to have an enemy. The machine spits out a bandito. Let's deport them. Not the guy in my barn. These are good Calvinists, by and large, listening to the governor of Florida. They say they don't like Trump's depravity, but they don't mind the stuff about immigrants. The immigrants make the ice cream, too. The people in the audience have come to believe that the immigrant is the problem and not the system that makes up the crisis that does not exist in Sioux Center or Storm Lake. Everybody knows we need more help here in Iowa and at the border for asylum processing, but they don't want to let them through. President Biden tries to talk as tough as Trump. If you don't stay back, we'll lock you up. All good sense is thrown out the window. You don't even know who's responsible for your food while you're talking smack and eating it. Next, from the New York Times, we have Oath Keepers leader is sentenced to 18 years in January 6th sedition case. This written by Alan Feuer. Stuart Rhodes, the leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia, was sentenced on Thursday to 18 years in prison for his conviction on seditious conspiracy charges for the role he played in helping to mobilize the pro-Trump attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021. The sentence, handed down in federal district court in Washington, was the most severe penalty so far in the more than 1,000 criminal cases stemming from the Capitol attack, and the first to be increased for fitting the legal definition of terrorism. It was also the first to have been given to any of the 10 members of the Oath Keepers and another far-right group, the Proud Boys, who were convicted of sedition in connection with the events of January 6th. From Mr. Rhodes, 58, the sentence was the end of a tumultuous and unusual career that included Army service, a stint on Capitol Hill, and a law degree from Yale. His role as the Oath Keepers' founder and leader thrust him into the spotlight and will now send him to prison for what is likely to be the better part of his remaining days. At a dramatic, nearly 4-hour hearing, Judge Emmett P. Mehta chided Mr. Rose for seeking for years through his leadership of the Oath Keepers to have American democracy devolve into violence. Quote, "You, sir," Judge Metha went on, directly addressing the defendant, "present an ongoing threat and a peril to this country, to the Republic, and the very fabric of our democracy," unquote. As the hearing opened, prosecutors urged Judge Metha to sentence Mr. Rhodes to 25 years in prison, arguing that accountability was needed for the violence at the Capitol and that American democracy was on the line. Catherine L. Rakowski, one of the lead prosecutors in the case, told Judge Metha that Mr. Rhodes had been calling for attacks against the government for more than a decade, and that his role in the January 6th attack was part of a long-standing pattern. The Oath Keepers' leader, Ms. Rakowski, said, exploited his talents and influence to goad his followers into rejecting the results of the 2020 election and ultimately mobilized them into storming the Capitol in two separate military-style stacks in a violent effort to keep President Donald J. Trump in office. Quote, "It is conduct that threatened and continues to threaten the rule of law in the United States," she said. Ms. Rakowski also noted that Mr. Rhodes had shown no remorse for undermining the lawful transition of power and continued to advocate political violence. Just 4 days ago, she said, Mr. Rhodes gave an interview from jail, repeating the lie that the election had been marred by fraud and asserting that the government was, quote, coming after those on the political right, unquote. Quote, "It's not going to stop until it stopped," Mr. Rhodes said during the interview, adding that the country needed regime change. As if to prove the government's point, Mr. Rhodes, in an orange prison smock and his trademark black eye patch, gave a defiant address to the court, blaming the news media for demonizing the Oath Keepers for leading the Capitol attack. He also compared himself to the Soviet-era dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn and to the beleaguered main character in the Kafka novel, The Trial. Quote, "I am a political prisoner," Mr. Rhodes said. The hearing opened a week of sentencing proceedings for eight other members of the Oath Keepers who were convicted at two separate trials in November and January of charges that included not only seditious conspiracy, but also the obstruction of a congressional proceeding to certify the 2020 election. One of Mr. Rhodes's deputies, Kelly Meigs, who once led the group's Florida chapter, was set to be sentenced later on Thursday. The process for sentencing all the defendants began on Wednesday, when some police officers and congressional staff members testified about the horror they experienced on January 6th. Several spoke through tears on the witness stand, describing lasting symptoms of post-traumatic stress, and survivors' guilt, particularly after many of their colleagues resigned and some died by suicide in the months after the attack. Quote, "I am an introverted, depressed shell of my former self," said Harry Dunn, a Capitol police officer who encountered members of the Oath Keepers in the Capitol Rotunda. When Mr. Dunn referred to the officers who were injured on January 6th as real Oath Keepers, he shot an angry glance toward Mr. Rhodes and other members of the group in the courtroom. In court papers filed this month, prosecutors dwelled on the importance of severely punishing Mr. Rhodes and his subordinates, stating that the acceptance of political violence was on the rise in the United States and that lengthy prison terms were needed to serve as a deterrent against future unrest. Quote, "As this court is well aware, the justice system's reaction to January 6th bears the weighty responsibility of impacting whether January 6th becomes an outlier or a watershed moment," the prosecutors wrote. Quote, "Left unchecked, this impulse threatens our democracy," unquote. In the end, Judge Metha said he had imposed a harsh sentence because seditious conspiracy was, quote, among the most serious crimes an individual in America can commit, unquote. He also scolded Mr. Rhodes, telling him that he had not been prosecuted because of his political beliefs, but rather because he had, quote, prepared to take up arms and foment revolution, simply because he did not like the results of an election. Quote, that's what you did, Judge Mehta said. You're not a political prisoner, Mr. Rhodes. You're here because of your actions, unquote. The trial of Mr. Rhodes, Mr. Meigs, and three other defendants, Kenneth Harrelson, Jessica Watkins, and Thomas Caldwell, was a milestone in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation of the Capitol attack. The convictions of Mr. Rhodes and Mr. Meigs on seditious conspiracy charges was the first time that federal prosecutors had won a sedition case since 1995, when a group of Islamic militants was found guilty of plotting to bomb several landmarks in New York. As part of Mr. Rhodes's plot, prosecutors maintained, Mr. Rhodes placed a quick-action force of heavily armed Oath Keepers at a Comfort Inn in Arlington County, Virginia, ready to rush their weapons into Washington if their compatriots at the Capitol needed them. Now, let's return to local news from the Courier. Madison Street work underway. Dateline Waterloo. Contractors have started reconstruction of Madison Street from Bell Avenue to Virgil Street. In order for the contractor to begin pavement removal, a full road closure will be required. The road closure will be in effect for approximately 10 weeks, depending on the weather. The planned work for this street includes removal of the existing pavement and driveway approaches, installation of new water main and storm sewer and sanitary sewer manholes, new concrete pavement and driveway approaches, and sod from the back of the new curb to the front edge of the sidewalk or right-of-way limits. For safety's sake, people are asked to stay away from the construction area. Heavy equipment will be moving back and forth on the closed street. It would be advisable to stay behind the sidewalk on the property side during the reconstruction work. Next, Waterloo to hold 4th Street Bridge Lighting Celebration. Dateline Waterloo. A bridge lighting celebration of the 4th Street Bridge in Waterloo will take place at 8:45 p.m. Thursday. And the story begins with a color photograph of the 4th Street Bridge with a lighted tower in the foreground that's in red light, and a lighted tower can be seen at the end of the bridge in blue light. The celebration begins at 7 p.m. at Anton's Garden, 518 Sycamore Street, where the bar will be open with food and music. At 8:45 p.m., guests will walk to the Vietnam Memorial Monument at 100 East 4th Street, where speakers will highlight details of the bridge that will honor veterans and entertain spectators through its evolving light display illuminating nightly. A ribbon cutting will follow the light show starting around 9:15 p.m. Speakers will include Mayor Quentin Hart, Bridge Light Show designer Rob Shakespeare, Bridge Lighting Community Chair Mary Robinson, Blackhawk County Veterans Affairs Director Yolando Lovelace, and representatives from Blackhawk Gaming Association, Waterloo Development Corporation, Ritland and Cooper Landscape Architects, and Main Street Waterloo. The bridge will be closed during the event. Next, Cunningham Elementary gets new assistant principal. Dateline Waterloo. Lindsay Haying has been named new assistant principal at Dr. Walter Cunningham School for Excellence, effective August 1st, pending approval by the Waterloo School Boards of Directors. Haying is currently a lead support teacher in the Iowa City Community School District. She has facilitated the learning and training of district special education behavior interventionists, developed behavior intervention plans, and provided guidance and consulting to administrators and teams on special education compliance and family-school communications. quote, "We are extremely excited to have Lindsay join our Cunningham family in this leadership role," said Neldreka Whitaker, Cunningham principal. Quote, "She comes with a wealth of knowledge in special education and in literacy and will be an asset to our students, teachers, staff, and community." Haying's K-12 teaching experience spans 22 years, during which she has served as a special education and literacy consultant, as well as a behavior strategist and special education program lead. Haying holds her bachelor's in elementary education with a reading endorsement from Wartburg College, her master's in education leadership from Upper Iowa University, and her PK-12 administrator special education supervisor at Iowa Evaluator Licensure from Viterbo University. Quote, "I am looking forward to returning to the Waterloo area to be a student-centered leader who is both visible and vulnerable," said Haying. Quote, "I am passionate about providing an equitable education for all students and am excited to work side by side with the Cunningham staff to help all students achieve at high levels," unquote. Haying replaces Michaela Montgomery, who has accepted the position of school improvement consultant with the Central Rivers Area Education Agency. And now, friends, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, May 26th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. We want to remind you that you can listen to a recording of today's reading of the Courier and the other newspapers around the state of Iowa that we read on our website, iowaradioreading.org. You can do that at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.